Hello and welcome to episode 1 of series 4 of LOL Science. Today we're going to be talking about nuclear fusion and fission, the differences between the two, and also how nuclear fusion may be the answer to our current energy problems. Later on I'll be discussing one of the reasons behind the Big Bang, or at least one of the leading theories at the moment, and at the end Andrew will be giving us a famous quote from a scientist. Enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome back to LOL Science, and welcome to a brand new series. This is series 4 of LOL Science, and you're listening to episode 1. As always, I'm joined by Andrew Payne.
Hello.
And to begin with, in this podcast, we're going to be talking about nuclear fusion and fission and the differences between the two. So to start with, I may as well talk about nuclear fission. So this is what we're currently using in our modern day nuclear power stations. And this process involves the splitting of a nucleus. And they then split into smaller nuclei, and these are lighter nuclei. And the process of this results in an excess of neutrons and photons. And as we know, photons are the building blocks of light, and in this particular instance, it produces gamma rays. And because of the combined efforts of the neutrons and the high energy photons, this process releases a large amount of energy. And this can then trigger a chain reaction, with the neutrons then colliding with more uranium atoms. And this happens with all of our modern day nuclear power stations. Nuclear fusion, however, is a different process, and it's more like the opposite. This is where two or more atomic nuclei actually join together, or fuse, to form a single, heavier nucleus. Now this has the potential to form a lot more power than what we're currently using, and this very process is being used by the Sun that we have at the moment, and any main sequence star, in fact, uses the process of nuclear fusion.
Going back to what Dominic said about nuclear fission, this is the current type of energy production used in modern-day nuclear power plants. And because of the splitting of the atom in the form of radioactive decay, radioactive waste can form. This can then go on to cause nuclear disasters. We know many of them.
Yeah.
Chernobyl, Three Mile Island,
and obviously,
Fukushima,
yeah, the most recent.
And probably not the last.
Yeah. So, as Andrew was saying, one of the main differences between the two is the fact that as an atom splits by the process of nuclear fission, there's actually radioactive decay going on. And this is actually a key difference because in nuclear fusion, this doesn't take place. And this is why in nuclear fission, we get radioactive waste, but we don't in nuclear fusion.
So, surely we should start looking forward to getting to a point where we can use nuclear fusion. I mean, it's going to be very hard to control, but once we do, we won't have to worry about global warming anymore.
I think. The main problem at the moment is controlling this, because as I mentioned earlier, nuclear fusion has the potential to produce really vast amounts of energy. Look at the hydrogen bomb, for example. This is an example of a nuclear fusion explosive. This, I think, is our largest bomb we've ever managed to produce, and something
it was first dropped in 1951 by the British on a remote Pacific island, and I think to this day that there's still adverse effects of that being dropped. That's how powerful
is. Actually, you say adverse effects, but one of the effects that won't be present is radioactive decay or radioactive waste formed in the area. As we know of the atomic attacks in the Second World War in Japan, there is still to this very day radioactive traces left there. However, with nuclear fusion, as we've been saying, there is no radioactive waste, no radioactive particles whatsoever. So that's one of the leading advantages of nuclear fusion. So although it's very difficult to control, and although if it goes wrong, as we see with the hydrogen bomb, it's a massive explosion, the actual long-term effects are not necessarily so vast. And we won't have the same kind of impacts as we see from Chernobyl, because we haven't got any radioactive waste or radioactive particles moving anywhere.
So it's essentially the eco-warriors' best bet to help everyone. Because if we go completely green power and start using solar panels, it doesn't necessarily benefit the huge electricity eaters like the TV stations, satellites, anything like that. So nuclear fusion is a real alternative. We just have to get to that stage.
Yeah. And if you take solar panels, for example, as you were saying, currently it costs of a great amount of money, but also a great amount of energy to be able to produce, vaguely efficient ones. Even our current solar panels are actually relatively, poor in efficiency, and it's certain that they will never, in the short term anyway, be able to provide our current energy demands.
I know that they have this mirror plant in Spain, but we can't have them everywhere. These countries out there. I mean, here in Britain, we're quite lucky. We benefit from the Gulf Stream. From the same latitude, we should be a frozen wasteland. But countries like Canada, which and Sweden and Scandinavia, which don't get very much sun and solar panels, they would be without power rather quickly.
If you go back to that mirror plant that you were talking about in Spain, in fact, that can only power, I believe, off the top of my head, about 20,000 homes. And although that sounds like a lot, it actually takes up a space which is equivalent to some of our power stations, our nuclear power stations that we have. So if you compare the output of that in a nuclear power station, and also the fact that these solar plants, although obviously green and no carbon emissions or anything, they actually have a relatively poor output compared to the space and cost it takes to produce them. And also, geographical location is a key issue there. Spain is a notoriously very hot and sunny country. However, as you were saying, countries like Canada may not be able to benefit from these kind of things. So this is why nuclear fusion is kind of a savior in a way for what we have. And another key fact about it is that there's no carbon emissions. Nuclear power at the moment has no carbon emissions, and nuclear fusion doesn't either. So things like fossil fuels, although there's no radioactive waste, there is carbon emissions. And with nuclear fusion, we have no radioactive waste, no carbon emissions, and a great amount of power.
The only problem with nuclear fusion, as we said earlier, controlling it, which is something is a lot easier to do with nuclear fission, because essentially what you just do is you douse it in a lot of water, which is what we did in Fukushima. When we realised that it's gone down, we just flooded it instantly, and that's what we do in a lot of power stations now, these emergency setup. And that not doesn't stop it, but it helps control the effect. So we can, if we're fast enough at thinking, control nuclear fission problems.
And as you were saying, nuclear fusion is also far more difficult to actually achieve this safe and long-term extraction from it. Because in theory, we may need to heat the particles within the nuclear fusion reactor to super high temperatures, and this particular process is called thermonuclear fission. Oh, sorry, fusion. We may even need to use beam-to-beam fusion. Now, beam is the fifth state of matter, and that requires vast amounts of energy in order to heat it to that stage. So that's another kind of barrier that we have in achieving nuclear fusion, is the fact that just the amount of heat and temperatures you may need to heat it up to make it achieve the processes that we need, and add on the difficulty of being able to contain the actual reactor and make it stable. That's obviously one of the main issues at the moment.
This is a problem with a lot of things. Our brains are just far too advanced for what we are right now. We can think of these amazing things like wormholes. We've thought of amazing ideas of wormholes. Unfortunately, we can't, at this stage in the universe life, we can't make it. To make a wormhole, we need more energy than all the suns of the universe combined. So that's something we've thought of and put together, but we can't actually put it into effect. We're too advanced for our own good, in a word.
As you say, we have, theoretically, nuclear fusion is absolutely 100% possible. I mean, look at the stars, they do it, although not in a very controlled manner. Look at like mass coronal ejections and
Because
stuff.
they don't have a problem of destroying the city next to them, as the nearest city is a good few miles away.
So, although in theory it is certainly possible to achieve energy from nuclear fusion, there's no doubt about that. It's just scientifically, it's incredibly difficult to do so. I mean, 20 years ago or so, they were saying they were on the verge of doing that, and they said within the next 10 or so years we'll have nuclear fusion reactors. And fast forward to modern days, we still don't have that kind of technology available, and even now they're saying at least another 15, 20 years. However, in the long run, if it does succeed, if we can make sustainable, safe, large-scale fusion reactors, honestly, it is the best current solution we have, because it's relative to the amount of power you can get from it. They're relatively cheap compared to how much power you actually get from such a reactor.
I've got a feeling that we'll be seeing nuclear fusion reactors in our lifetimes in full effect, like we see in nuclear fission reactors. I mean, the idea of a nuclear fission reactor was first invented in 1938, although it wasn't introduced until 1951. And that's fairly new. It's only 61 years ago that this happened. So it could happen pretty soon, I think. And we'll soon be benefiting from nuclear fusion. And we won't necessarily have to worry too much about destroying the ozone layer as much as we are now. We just have to more focus on us rather than our power. We can use nuclear fusion to power electric cars instead of petrol. So nuclear fusion benefits more than just heating our radiators. It benefits everything.
And back to the point earlier about how long it takes to get these up and running. As you said, 1938 nuclear fission reactors were invented, and then it took to 1951 until they were actually introduced. I mean, at the moment we have theoretical plans of nuclear fusion reactors, but then you said in our lifetime we may be able to see them, but there are quite a lot of stages in between. I mean, first of all, we need to get a working reactor, and that may, you know, we may do that in the next 10, 20 years. But then to comply with all these regulations and to make it actually implemented on a national and global scale, there's many more barriers that we see, not only in legislation, but actually, you know, is it actually technically feasible? Is it good enough? So it's, I hope they are available in our lifetime, but there are still quite a lot of stages to go through. It's not like they're just around the corner.
That's the problem with new ideas. It may sound absolutely wonderful, but though with the government regulations, I mean, different countries have different regulations. So say we set this up in some barren wasteland like the Sahara Desert, it's going to be very difficult to get it from Africa to England, because it's going to have to pass through so many different territories which might have different rules or regulations. They might say we want 50% of the power coming through our country, another country might say so and so. So we'll end up with quite a... So we need to have them fairly close to home, but unfortunately we're quite a condensed country. There isn't much of an area where we can stick, essentially, a hydrogen bomb and blow it up. So if we can't stick one of them in Britain, we can't exactly stick a nuclear fusion reactor.
Yeah, you say that, although we do have nuclear fission reactors at the moment. Although they don't blow up so big, as we mentioned earlier, they definitely do have radioactive waste. And as we look from Chernobyl, that spread across the whole of northern and western Europe, from the far east of Europe. And that really affected loads of countries. It affected food supply, food stocks, there were mutations. And although the actual number of deaths were relatively low, it did obviously have knock-on effects to the supply of things like goods and
It's only recently that produce like mutton and beef from Wales has only just been able to go into countries like Saudi Arabia, because it's just finally past the stage where it isn't contaminated enough. That's how far it's spread.
And even now in Wales, they are still doing radioactive tests as a result of the Chernobyl disaster. So, although nuclear fusion has the potential, with linking back to the hydrogen bomb, it has the potential to explode and make chaotic destruction, if we actually think about the long-term events and the long-term effects, they're not necessarily so great.
Luckily, we in Britain, we have Cumbria, where we currently store all our nuclear waste. We don't store it on site. That would have a lot more adverse effects if we kept all the nuclear waste on site.
And that's, at the moment, the only thing that's really against nuclear fission at the moment is the fact that, one, it's slightly unstable, and the radioactive waste is obviously a very, very key point. I mean, at the moment, I personally believe, and this is my personal opinion, I personally believe that nuclear fission reactors are at the moment our best bet. If we have to choose one particular power source, they are our best bet at the moment in trying to satisfy our energy demands. However, there are still a lot of problems, and many people can't accept them because of this radioactive waste. And although they don't have carbon emissions, if we look at nuclear fusion, they don't have carbon emissions, but also there's no radioactive waste.
No matter what you do, there will always be the critics and the people who don't necessarily support it. That will always be there, but it's generally the majority which decides. But you've got to remember that nuclear fission still has non-renewable sources. Uranium can't just be created at a click of the fingers.
Yeah,
it is a natural resource which we are using up,
and
We will run out of that
And
eventually.
that's kind of another benefit of nuclear fusion if we take it on the other side, because the bonding of two atoms, we can use even simple atoms such as hydrogen. Now, as I said, the hydrogen bomb. So hydrogen isn't in such a scarce supply.
It's the most abundant
Well, in the
element
universe,
in the
but
universe.
not necessarily in our system, but that's like in our local system, but that's
We have enough to get us
yeah.
by.
So if we you can use many different variants for nuclear fusion. It's not just limited to hydrogen, you know, you can go up to anything from the weight of hydrogen to iron, and anything in that scale will still be able to produce some kind of energy output. So it's definitely not as limiting as nuclear fission. And although the uranium supplies and plutonium supplies are still going to last as a long, long time, if we think about our current demand for it, there is this backup if we think about nuclear fusion in the long run. There's not really any limiting factors that's stopping us apart from
Political
the
factors.
political, financial, and also being able to control the actual explosion. Physics with Dom. Hello and welcome to this week's physics segment. Now, over the course of the next three podcasts, I'll be explaining to you a different reason or a different theory behind the Big Bang and our ever-expanding universe. And today I'm going to be talking about brain theory. And when I say brain, I mean in the sense of membranes. So if you imagine a sheet of paper, it's almost infinitely thin and stretched out over a distance, like the membrane on the top of a drum. Now, this theory states that there's four-dimensional brains floating around in a space which is of a higher level of dimensions, for example, 11 dimensions. Now, this incorporates the very basics of string theory, which states that there's more than the four dimensions we see around us, those four being the three spatial dimensions and also time, which can often be counted as a dimension.
So how many other dimensions are we thinking of in this advanced, more advanced book space?
Well, string theory states that you can have as many dimensions as you really want, but this theory has proposed to have around 10, 11, 12 dimensions. But the mathematics behind that and how they came to that number is very complicated, so it's not easy to explain that. But if I go back to this theory, how did our Big Bang come around from these brains? Well, first of all, the idea is that these brains are kind of empty. They've only got energy, if you will. There's no mass there. And one of the main properties of a brain is that when they collide or exchange energy, they expand very rapidly. Now, this theory states that our universe was formed when two of these empty brains collided. And if you imagine, like, clapping your hands, and if you're going to slow down that motion, there's a central point of contact, a singularity where all the energy from your two hands actually collide to begin with. And that's where they exchange their energy. And it's the same theory for these brains. And the idea that is that our Big Bang originated from this very central point of contact, this singularity. And this explains how our universe may have expanded so rapidly in this first second. It's because all the energy in these brains was focused on this particular point. And as we know, E equals mc squared, so mass and energy can be interchanged. So the reason why our universe has mass could be because this energy was then converted into it because of the vast amounts that our universe received when these two brains collided.
So this could also prove other things, such as the multiverse, because surely it won't just be these two membranes out there. So this highly supports this theory, which I also agree to think is possible. But this other universe out there, which might be impossible to get to.
And this is one of the great things about brain theory in particular, because not only does it explain our Big Bang, but it also explains a lot of other things. First of all, it incorporates string theory, so it allows a use for that. But also, as Andrew said very rightly, it explains multiverse theory, because there's more than two brains, obviously. There's, in fact, this states that there could be an infinite number of brains. And when these so-called brains accidentally collide, a universe forms. So if you think about it, there could be hundreds, thousands, billions, even an infinite number of universes forming in bulk space. Now, bulk space is a higher dimensional of space, so more than four dimensions. And this theory also explains dark energy. and dark energy is what is seemingly making our universe expand faster than before. It also explains how it's expanded faster than the speed of light in that opening second. And the idea behind this dark energy comes from these four-dimensional brains.
So, one question I have to ask you here, out of all the possible theories for the theory of the Big Bang theory, is this one you support?
Personally, I believe it's one of the best, if you could call it that, because it not only explains our universe and how that came about, but as I said earlier, it explains a lot of other things. And it's actually, although it's quantum physics and really difficult and spatial dimensions and string theory, it's relatively easy to grasp. Although there's a lot of, you know, hardcore mathematics behind that, it's quite a simple theory, and the human mind can kind of conceive it, and how they would, it's, you just have to imagine that we're not in the highest level of space, we're actually a smaller universe within something larger, and that's how we would come around.
Like, we have the God particle, which is the Higgs boson. I suppose it could go to somewhere else. So this is, in a sense, a higher being. It created the universe.
Yeah.
If you support the theory, and it happened. Unfortunately, as a famous physicist once said, a theory can only be proved, only disproved.
Yeah, that's one thing. It would be incredibly hard to actually find proof for this. And another thing is, although it explains our Big Bang and our ever-expanding universe, there isn't something currently that explains this and how bulk space came around. I mean, there could be other theories out there, or you could just maybe have to accept that it's something that lives indefinitely and it's beyond our human conception, and bulk space has always been bulk space. It was never created, it will never end, all that stuff. So it's quite difficult to really think beyond this.
I just have trouble thinking that something was always being there. For me, everything has to have a start.
Yeah.
Even as a Christian, I believe everything has a start. Nothing was always being there, because it's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah. And I suppose as humans, if you think about it, it may be even in our nature, because if you look back at our life, it started somewhere. If we look back at our planet, it started somewhere. Our solar system, it started somewhere. We can even wind back to our universe and say it started somewhere. But then we're getting beyond our realms of being able to, our understanding. So we think everything must have a start, but maybe not. And it's one of the many questions that is still to be answered by science.
This week in the news.
Also in the news, a new chemical bond has been discovered that is possible under extreme magnetic fields. Now, this is a bond other than covalent or ionic bonding, and is big news for the chemical industry.
And scientists have created a virtual cell that stimulates life. This is essentially an artificial life force.
And finally, there's a new flu virus found in seals that could concern scientists.
Andrew's scientific quote of the week. Hello, and my quote this week is from a famous physicist. You may have heard of him. He went by the name of Albert Einstein, and he said that the process of scientific discovery is in effect a continual flight from wonder. Now, continual means proceeding without interruption of any form, but the odd thing about this is another quote of Einstein's was that he defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting different results. This is essentially science. We do different tests, expecting different results to try and prove things. CERN is one of the Large Hadron Collider. But the main thing that Einstein is saying here is theories and hypotheses and all these sort of things all derive from sheer wonder, and a physicist wondering, why does that happen? What would happen if I do this, etc., etc. This is a lot more important than people give it credit for, because it's the basis of all hypotheses. Professor Higgs, when walking in the Cairn Gardens in Scotland, came up with the idea of a Higgs boson because he just wondered. Galileo wondered when he was dropping the cannonballs. Newton wondered why this apple was dropping, what caused it to drop. And ended up coming up with the theory of gravity, and he came up with all sorts of laws of motion, including the third law, which every action has a complete and opposite reaction. So if I drop this piece of paper, this thrust forces it to slow down.
Yeah. So what relevance do you think this has in today's society? Do you think it's still relevant?
I think it's always going to be relevant, because these scientific discoveries will always come from wonder. There won't be a point where we just come up with a hypothesis. We'll have to think and wonder. You don't just think about things, you wonder about them first. These ideas come into your head due to a brainstorm of the mind, essentially.
Yeah. Well, part of the scientific process is that in order to come up with a hypothesis, you need to not only have observations, but you need to have some kind of an explanation in your mind behind it, and this is what you're getting at, I think.
It's essentially, scientists have to have a good imagination to come up with all these ideas. There could be millions more things out there which we don't even conceive right now, but we will do.
Yeah.
When we get to that point, apparently, wonder.
Yeah, apparently, like, in 20 years' time, we'll know 95% more than we do now, or something like that. So it's, we really are expanding our knowledge.
If theory is an hypothesis in theoretical physics, which is what I said was it with a theoretical physicist, if it was a graph, it would just be a complete upward trend from point zero to now. It would just be a completely upward trend, because we're constantly thinking. And even those who aren't distinguished scientists will have ideas and hypotheses. Unfortunately, being that they are very distinguished, it might be very hard for them to get taken seriously, but everyone will have an idea. And this is essentially what this quote is saying. And it's one of my favourite Einstein quotes, and this is why I chose it this week.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lore Science. If you enjoyed it, why not support us by going over to www.lore-science.blogspot.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at LoreSci. Alternatively, you can like us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/LoreSci. Thank you for listening.